and realize that the young blonde-haired woman sitting up in bed, holding a baby in a blue bunny rug, must be Colleen, Patrick's wife, his dead wife. Ellen wondered if the cancer cells that would take her life just a year later were already there in her body, gathering force for their malignant attack. Patrick must have climbed up on the bed next to his wife. They were squashed close together, with their backs propped against the bars of the hospital bed. Colleen had one arm around the baby, and the other hand lay entwined with Patrick's on his lap. You could tell he was holding it tightly. Colleen was smiling at the baby. Patrick was smiling at the person taking the photo. It was only 8 years ago, but Patrick looked so much younger and different. His eyes seemed rounder, his cheeks chubbier, his hair thicker and longer, his t-shirt a younger person's t-shirt. Colleen's hair was messy and Patrick was unshaven. It must have been taken only hours after Jack was born. They had that amazed look about them that Ellen had seen in other people's first baby shots. Look what we did! The birth of a first baby. One of those everyday events that only seem incredible to the people involved. Ellen felt vaguely embarrassed. She'd spent the day thinking about sex in the shower with that young woman's husband. How tacky. He'd had a real relationship with Colleen. He'd married her, had a child with her. It had been a grown-up relationship. You could tell how much Patrick had loved Colleen by the way his body was curved around hers. Ellen felt a sense of kinship with poor, silly, crazy Saskia standing at the front door, still holding on, making a fool of herself. If the lovely Colleen, you could tell she was lovely just from the photo, hadn't died, Patrick would never have spared a glance for Saskia or Ellen. Dying was such an elegant way to leave a relationship. No infidelity, no boredom, no long, complicated conversations late into the night. No, she's still single, I hear. No running into each other at parties and weddings. No, she's stacked on the weight, or she's showing her age. Dying was final and mysterious and gave you the last word forever. That's my mum! Ellen started. Jack was standing next to her, looking at the photo in her hand. That's the day I was born. My mum is dead. Yes. Ellen carefully put the photo back in its place. She wondered if Jack felt the same way about his dead mother as she did about her non-existent father. A sort of emotion without emotion. I know. My dad's ex-girlfriend is at the front door, said Jack. Saskia. She lived with us for a while. Do you remember her? Asked Ellen curiously. Jack looked shifty. Sort of. Like, I remember her picking me up from school, and she used to say, "Welcome back, Jack." She always had this little plate ready with biscuits and fruit and stuff. He gave her a quick, warning glance. Dad doesn't like to talk about her. I know, said Ellen. Why was Saskia picking him up from school? Didn't she have to work? Why wasn't Patrick picking him up after school? Out the front of the house, there was the sound of a woman's raised voice, and then a car door slammed and tires squealed. He said he would call the police if I didn't leave. I hadn't even known he was going to be there. I was so pleased with how good I looked in my red dress, and I still felt so cleansed from that naked swim at the beach. And I had this idea that going to visit Patrick's mum and dad was just a normal, social, everyday thing to do. I was half thinking that maybe it was time to start looking up some old friends, and they seemed like a good place to start. I didn't think of it as part of my habit, my dirty, nasty little habit. The proof is that I didn't even notice Patrick's car was parked out front, and I am fixated on that car. I've got so used to following it, my vision telescopes in on it even when I'm stuck in traffic miles behind. All I was thinking of as I walked up the front path was about the first time Patrick brought me here to meet his family. Jack running up the path ahead of us. I was nervous because it had been less than a year since Colleen had died, and I thought they might think I was too quick to snap up the grieving widower. I remember Simon was in his last year of school. He was still wearing his school uniform, and for some reason he'd got hold of some elastic bands and done his hair in a whole lot of tiny little pigtails sticking up all over his head, like a hedgehog's quills. Maureen kept apologizing for him. That's what I was thinking about as I walked up the driveway. How nice they'd all been to me. The front door looked exactly the same. Stupid. For an intelligent woman, sometimes I'm so, so stupid. Did I really think that just because their front door looked the same, that the last few years had never happened? That I was just a regular old friend dropping by? My capacity for self-delusion is enormous. Then I knocked on the door and I heard a burst of laughter, as if they were all laughing at me. It made me snap back to reality, and that's when I turned my head and saw Patrick's car. I couldn't believe I'd missed it, and I thought, he's brought Ellen over. He's introducing them to Ellen. I thought about running away, except that they would have seen me. And anyway, part of me wanted to march into that house to say, how can you meet this new woman as if I never existed? How can you do it all? The interested questions, the careful pouring of the not very good wine, the special Harbour Bridge tray, I bet, with the Jats biscuits, all exactly the same, except with a different woman. Doesn't that seem bizarre? Wrong? And then Jack opened the door. Of course I've seen him, more often than Patrick knows, but I haven't got this close to him since the day I left. I could have approached him many times, but I never wanted to confuse him or upset him. He smiled at me, the loveliest open smile. His beautiful eyes are still exactly the same. And then he started chatting with me, perfectly naturally, telling me about how I'd knocked at the same time as he'd said knock-knock to tell a knock-knock joke, and what are the chances of that happening? Like one chance in 1,000, in 1,000,000? And I was laughing when Maureen appeared, and she had a polite, perplexed expression on her face, and it vanished as soon as she saw me. She looked horrified, as if I was a home invader. And then Patrick appeared, his face so ugly with anger, and then his dad all serious and frowning as if there had been a car accident, and Simon all grown up, no pigtails, not even looking at me, just grabbing for Jack's hand as if he needed to rescue him from me. Nothing I said could make any difference. They just wanted me to go. I wanted to scream, but I loved you all. You were my family. We loved her, said Maureen to Ellen. We really did. Can we please change the subject to something more interesting? Said Patrick, but everyone ignored him. They had finished dinner and Jack had fallen asleep on the couch in the living room. And Ellen thought that everyone had maybe drunk a little more than they normally would have following the stress of the Saskia incident, and their tongues were loosening up nicely. Of course we were upset when Patrick broke up with her. I felt absolutely terrible for her, continued Maureen. She didn't have any family here, you see. She grew up in Tasmania, so we were like her family. I'm sure Ellen doesn't want to hear all this, said Patrick. I don't mind, said Ellen, which was the understatement of the century.
People fall out of love, said George. You can't blame him for how he felt.
I know that, George, said Maureen irritably. It doesn't stop me from feeling for the poor girl.
She needs to let Patrick be now, said George. This has gone on long enough.
She was like a mother to Jack. Maureen ignored her husband and talked directly to Ellen.
You should have let her keep seeing Jack, said Simon to Patrick. How many times do I have to say this? She never asked to see him, said Patrick. As soon as I said I wanted to end it, she just went crazy, completely certifiably crazy.
Her heart was broken, said Maureen.
Whatever. I didn't think Jack was safe around her.
Also, her mother had just died, said Maureen.
Yeah, your timing sort of sucked, said Simon.
She was very close to her mother, said Maureen to Ellen. They spoke on the telephone every single day. My boys would go crazy if I tried to speak to them every day. Although, of course, I'm sure it's different with daughters. She looked wistful for a moment. Do you speak to your mother every day, Ellen?
No, Ellen smiled. Although they did actually email or text or have some form of communication nearly every day.
Saskia's father died when she was very young, you see, and she had no sisters or brothers, so her mother was all the family she had, said Maureen. She took her mother's death very hard.
It was a month after her mother had died, said Patrick. Her mother had been sick for a whole year. How much longer was I meant to wait? I didn't think it was fair to her to keep pretending.
A month is nothing, said Simon. Ellen privately agreed.
Listen to Mr. Sensitive here. You broke up with your last girlfriend by text message, said Patrick.
It was a very caring text message. Anyway, I wasn't living with her. When Patrick first went into business for himself, he was very busy, obviously, and Saskia started working part-time so she could look after Jack. Maureen was directing all of her conversation at Ellen. She really was a wonderful mother to him.
Colleen was his mother, said Patrick.
Well, of course she was, darling, but Colleen wasn't there.
Which wasn't her fault.
Of course it wasn't. I'm just trying to be fair to Saskia and to say that she did a wonderful job.
Colleen would have done it better, and Colleen wasn't crazy.
You never dumped Colleen, said Simon, so you don't know.
I do know, said Patrick. I do know, and anyway, I would never have dumped Colleen.
There was a perceptible tremor of emotion in his voice that caused a hush around the table. Ellen saw that everyone was trying not to look at her. She felt Maureen's excellent roast lamb and baked potatoes sitting lumpily in her stomach.
Well, naturally he's still in love with his dead wife. The damn girl had to go and die before she had time to get boring or annoying.
Patrick's father took a deep breath and smiled at Ellen without quite meeting her eyes.
Well, I want to hear more about the hypnotism business.
Ellen smiled weakly. They had already talked at length about the hypnotism business over dinner.
I read somewhere that Hitler used hypnosis, said Simon.
Most politicians are experts at conversational hypnosis patterns, began Ellen automatically. She was asked this question all the time when she did speaking engagements.
Simple things like repetition.
There's an ad on TV at the moment, said Patrick, looking down at the table. I don't know what it's for, but it's got a man in a swimming pool and someone's old bloody bandage is floating in the water and it gets stuck to his mouth. And he pulls it off and throws it away with this sort of all-over shudder like, get it off! Get it off!
I know the one. It's for a car, said Simon.
What's an old bandage got to do with cars? Maureen frowned.
The point is that every time I see Saskia's car in the rear vision mirror, or I get another one of her letters ranting and raving about God knows what, or an email or a text, or I have to listen to her voice on my answering machine, or she delivers a bunch of fucking flowers, sorry for swearing, Mum, but roses to my work, I feel like that guy in the ad. I just want to get it off. Get it off!
She sent you roses? Said Maureen. She sent flowers to a man?
So that's why I don't want to hear that Saskia was a great mother or that my timing sucked when I broke up with her, said Patrick. If I did wrong by her, I have paid the price. I have paid and paid and paid.
With that, he stood up from the table and left the room.
Oh, dearie me, sighed Maureen.
Welcome to our family, Ellen, said Simon brightly.
He started up with Saskia too soon after he lost Colleen, said Maureen. That was the problem, much too soon. He never grieved. Men are terrible grievers. Whenever they feel anything bad, they just try and stomp it down.
Whereas women talk and talk everything to death, said George.
Talking helps, said Maureen. She turned her attention back to Ellen. After we lost Colleen, Patrick got this thing in his head that he had to be a good provider for Jack. He was obsessed with it. He threw himself into work. That's why Saskia ended up doing so much for Jack. Patrick was working all the time.
Mum, I think we've probably shared enough with Ellen for one night, said Simon.
Maybe you're right, said Maureen. She stood up and began to stack plates, and without looking at Ellen, she said quickly,
Tell me, Ellen, are you a Catholic by any chance?
Simon snorted.
I'm not, actually, said Ellen apologetically.
Oh, well that's... And do you mind me asking what religion you are?
Maureen took her husband's plate.
Not that it matters, of course. I was just curious.
Well, I'm not really anything, said Ellen. I wasn't brought up in any particular religion. My mother's a staunch atheist.
Maureen looked startled.
A staunch? You mean she doesn't believe in God? Not at all. But you do, of course.
Isn't there some rule about not discussing religion or politics at the dinner table? Said Simon.
I guess I'm more of a spiritual person than my mother, said Ellen. I'm very interested in Buddhism, for example. I like its philosophies, practicing mindfulness, that sort of thing.
Oh, yes, I've heard that's all very in at the moment, said Maureen.
Ellen could sense that she was losing points.
Om,
chanted George. He placed his palms together under his chin and bowed his head.
That's what you Buddhists do, isn't it? Om, om.
George, she's not an actual Buddhist, said Maureen.
She gave Ellen a frantic look.
That is, are you, darling?
Simon rocked with laughter.
I just find it interesting, said Ellen meekly.
Well, Maureen squared her shoulders, as if to say that one must soldier on whatever life throws at you. She tapped a finger to her mouth.
Do you like babies, Ellen?
Mom! Simon slapped a hand to his head. Ellen caught the roguish glint in Maureen's eyes. She knew exactly what she was doing.
I adore babies, she said firmly.
Lovely, said Maureen.
Me too.
They understood each other perfectly.
Having one for dessert, are we? Said George.
Maureen rolled her eyes.
We're having apple crumble with cream and ice cream.
Maybe just a very small portion for me, said Ellen.
Oh, you're as thin as a rake, scolded Maureen.
I'll get you a nice big plate.
Later that night, Ellen and Patrick lay in her bed, flat on their backs, both of them sucking on antacid tablets. At Maureen's insistence, Jack had stayed with her for another night. Patrick had carried him from the couch into her spare room, and he hadn't woken at all. Then Patrick and Ellen had caught a taxi back to her place because they'd both had too much to drink.
I'm sorry about tonight, said Patrick.
It was fine, said Ellen. I think your family is lovely. It was true. There was something about the Scott family that made her feel surprisingly comfortable, as if she'd sat at that dining room table and passed around baked potatoes many times before.
I shouldn't have let that conversation about Saskia go on like it did, said Patrick. I just get resentful when they seem to be on her side.
I know, said Ellen, rolling over to touch his shoulder. It felt rock hard as though all his muscles were contracted.
She kneaded his flesh with her fingers, trying to ease his tension.
I understand.
And I should never have yelled at Saskia in front of Jack, said Patrick. I just felt this sort of crazy fury when I heard her voice. I thought for a while there that I could just accept her in my life, like a disability. But now I seem to be going in the opposite direction. It's like I'm reaching the end of my tether. Sometimes I think I could kill her. I understand now how people get to that point. The point of murder. I could kill her.
Please don't, said Ellen.
She stopped massaging him. It didn't seem to be helping. I don't want to see you in jail for conjugal visits.
I'd make sure I didn't get caught, said Patrick.
He removed another tablet from the roll he was holding on his chest and chewed it grimly.
Ellen glanced with concern at his face. He saw her looking and smiled.
It's all right, he said. I'm just joking. Anyway, I would get caught. I'm the sort of person who never gets away with anything. I do an illegal right-hand turn and the cops are waiting around the corner.
Speaking of the police...
Yes, I know. Patrick's jaw shifted convulsively. I don't know. I'm just not sure if that's the way to go.
He obviously didn't want to go back to the police again, but she couldn't quite pinpoint his reasons. Was it just his fear that Saskia would do what she'd threatened and make accusations against him, or something more than that?
Think about it, she said.
I will. But she could tell that he wouldn't.
She yawned suddenly and hugely.
I can't believe how tired I feel.
I'm going to be awake for hours, said Patrick, with my thoughts going round and round like a merry-go-round. Could you just hypnotize me to sleep?
Ha, said Ellen.
Seriously, can you do that?
Hypnotizing your partners isn't considered such a good idea, you know, ethically, she said, feeling prudish. It had come up before in previous relationships, but mostly the requests had been flippant and she'd been able to brush them off.
I won't report you, said Patrick. I just want to switch off all these thoughts in my head.
Her heart went out to him. She wavered.
I thought you didn't really like the idea of hypnotism. You said you hated the idea of losing control. That was before I met you. I understand more about it now. And I trust you. Ellen thought of her mentor, Flynn, an old-school hypnotherapist in his 60s who hated stage hypnotists with a passion and believed that the only way to protect his professional integrity was to never, ever practice his craft outside the therapist's office. She thought of the cool young guy she was mentoring, Danny, who proudly told Ellen that he used the hypnotic handshake to help pick up women in bars, with huge success apparently. So Ellen knew that it didn't matter how strenuously she disapproved. If she ever told Flynn about what she let Danny get away with, he'd be horrified, like a grandparent who thought she was spoiling her child. She guessed that on the ethical spectrum, she was somewhere in the middle of Flynn and Danny. I suppose there wouldn't be any harm in just doing a relaxation exercise, she said. Chapter 8. By the way, I'm not stalking you. Please stop using that word. You know it's ridiculous. I just want to talk to you. That's all. From an unopened email to Patrick Scott. So this guy in the US goes to court because he's being stalked by his ex-girlfriend, said Patrick. And the judge says, you should be flattered by the attention. And a few days later, he ends up dead. His stalker shot him or stabbed him or something. True story. It was Sunday afternoon, and Ellen, Patrick, Julia, and Patrick's friend Stinky, his real name still hadn't been confirmed, and both Ellen and Julia were too much their North Shore mother's daughters to bring themselves to call him Stinky, were eating fish and chips on a picnic rug at Watson's Bay. It was Julia who brought up the stalking issue. So, I hear you have a stalker, Patrick, she'd said within minutes of them all sitting down in the same sociable tone she'd used to say, so, I hear you're a surveyor, Patrick. Ellen had been surprised that Patrick hadn't tried to change the subject, especially after the previous night with his family. In fact, he responded almost enthusiastically. It was interesting seeing the slight variations in his personality when he was around different people. With his family, he was chattier, softer, boyish. With Stinky and Julia, he was a laid-back, nothing-worries-me Aussie bloke. But you're not in fear of your life, are you, Scotty? Asked Stinky. Stinky was chunky and balding, with two giant dimples creasing his cheeks, so he looked like a giant baby with grey stubble and a deep voice. He was also quite short for a man, something Patrick had neglected to mention, and Ellen had neglected to mention that Julia was quite tall for a woman. When Julia, who was looking especially cosmopolitan, with a fitted jacket and scarf and spike-heeled leather boots that made her look supermodel tall, had shaken hands with Stinky, who was wearing a rumpled country shirt and faded jeans with scuffed workman's boots, she'd raised one eyebrow over the top of his head at Ellen, who had shrugged back. This would become a story Julia would exaggerate for years to come. The time you tried to set me up with a bald midget called Stinky. But in a way, it was better that Julia had obviously written off Stinky, because she was completely relaxed, eating the hot chips like a machine, and even flirting a bit with Stinky. If she'd actually seen him as a prospect, she would have been avoiding eye contact and acting aggressively not interested, and she would have lost her appetite completely. I'm not in fear of my life, said Patrick, just my sanity at times. My point was that people don't take male stalking victims seriously. Did you ever meet this girl, you over there? Said Julia to Stinky. Look, can I get your real name, please? I just can't call you Stinky, and you seem to smell perfectly acceptable. It's Bruce. It's not. What's wrong with Bruce? I'm offended. Okay, Bruce. Did you ever meet her? Said Julia. Patrick Stalker? I knew her well, said Stinky. I liked her. I liked her a lot, actually. He glanced at Patrick, who shrugged and said, You want a phone number? You're welcome to her, mate. So you wouldn't have thought she was capable of this crazy stuff? Said Julia. Oh, I don't know. Stinky's dimple deepened. Aren't we all capable of it? I always think love is a kind of madness. Love is a kind of madness, repeated Julia. That's a very, poetic thing for a man called Bruce to say.
He's trying to impress the ladies, said Patrick.
The point is, said Julia, we've all been hurt by someone, but we just have to get on with it, don't we? That's life.
You've never Googled an ex? When my last girlfriend broke up with me, I spent hours cyber-stalking her, said Stinky. Even if I didn't physically stalk her, I stalked her in my mind.
So what? I might have raised my voice at my ex-husband, but that doesn't mean I'm in the same category as someone who murders their ex.
But doesn't it give you an understanding of how it could happen?
Nope, said Julia.
Oh, you're a hard woman.
You sure are, Ellen gave Julia a pointed look.
Okay, fine, said Julia. I once made anonymous phone calls to an ex-boyfriend's new girlfriend.
Just for a few weeks, and I was 17?
Aha! Stinky pointed his chip at her triumphantly. You've got a history as a stalker yourself.
I was not a stalker. I was just a silly teenager.
You're not in the same league as my bunny boiler, said Patrick. He paused. Sometimes I think she comes into my house when I'm not home.
You never told me that. Ellen turned to look at him. Report her to the police, for God's sake, said Julia, and change the locks.
What makes you think she's been there? Asked Stinky. I've changed the locks more than once, said Patrick, and I don't know what makes me think it. Just a feeling when I get home. Nothing has moved or anything. I just sense she's been there. Something in the atmosphere. Maybe I smell a trace of her perfume.
Ellen noticed that Patrick had avoided responding to Julia's comment about the police.
Julia shuddered theatrically.
Oh, God, that's like something out of a horror movie.
She pointed her chin in Ellen's direction.
Lucky your new girlfriend likes horror movies.
Do you? Patrick put his hand on Ellen's knee. I didn't know that. I'm a wimp. They scare me to death.
I like my horror with popcorn and a choc top, said Ellen. I don't like the idea of Saskia going through your house. I don't like that at all.
She shuddered, although part of her knew she was shuddering because it seemed like the expected response. She felt deeply sympathetic toward Patrick and understood his fear and anxiety, but for some reason she genuinely didn't feel any fear for herself. Perhaps it was because she hadn't met Saskia, and she still didn't feel quite real to her. Or perhaps it was just that Saskia was a woman and she didn't really believe that women were capable of violence, even though she knew, of course, that they were. Whatever the reason, she still found everything about Saskia more interesting than frightening.
Sorry, said Patrick. I never actually meant to tell you that. Anyway, I'm probably imagining it.
She'd never actually hurt anyone, said Stinky to Ellen, if that's any comfort to you. She was a pacifist. She marched against the war in Iraq.
That was political, said Patrick. This is personal.
Didn't she work for an animal shelter for a while?
An animal shelter? Snorted Julia.
What's funny about working for an animal shelter? Said Ellen.
I don't know, said Julia. It's such a cliché.
Not for the poor little kitties and puppies. Stinky looked mournful.
What is this? Patrick reached out and punched Stinky on the arm. I'm surrounded by people who want to defend my stalker.
Sorry, Scotty. Stinky held up both palms. I was trying to make Ellen feel better. Let her know she's not in danger.
Well, Scotty, unlike Stinky here, I'm not going to defend your stalker, said Julia to Patrick. I think she's an absolute nutcase, and you and Ellen should both be scared out of your minds.
Thank you, said Patrick.
I went to the beach again today and fell asleep on the sand in my red dress. Not the beach where the hypnotist lives or any of the beaches I've been to with Patrick. I went to Avalon. I'd never actually set foot on that beach before, so no memories. I made myself ill on memories last night. I overdosed on them. After I left Patrick's family's house, I didn't go to the party. Maybe I knew all along I wasn't going to go to the party. I don't do parties. I drove for 6 hours without a break, except once, when I stopped for petrol and a bottle of water. I drove to every place in Sydney I'd ever been to with Patrick. I drove back and forth across the Harbour Bridge at least 30 times. I was so in love with this city when I first came here. Sydney. Even just the name sounded exciting to me, like New York probably sounds to more sophisticated people who didn't grow up in a tiny grey smidge of a country town right in the middle of Tasmania.
You're from Tasmania, Sydney Siders used to say.
with a lifted eyebrow and half smile, when what they actually wanted to say was, "Really? That dear little place?" And I would duck my head humbly as if I was saying, "Don't hold it against me." That doesn't happen anymore. Now people murmur, "Oh, beautiful countryside in Tasmania." I don't know if it's me who's changed or Tasmania. Sydney is my big, brash, jewellery-wearing, credit card-flashing ex-lover. Sydney dazzled me with beaches and bars and sunshine, with restaurants and cafes, and music with that big, hard, glittery sapphire of a harbour. Like a silly, besotted girlfriend, I threw myself into finding out everything there was to know about this place. I know my way around Sydney better than any local or taxi driver. I can tell you where to go for the best yamcha and sushi and tapas. I know the theatres and the museums and the cool pubs. I know where to scuba dive, where to bushwalk, where to park. I'd only been living in Sydney for 6 months when I met Patrick, who has never lived anywhere else, and he didn't know half the places I took him to even existed. Patrick and Sydney gave me the best, most blissful time of my life. We kissed on ferries and drank champagne by the harbour. We saw plays and movies and bands. We took Jack, grinning down at me from Patrick's backpack, on long walks through the green, dappled light of the national parks. We held his hands on the beach and said, 1, 2, 3, and scooped him up high over waves that frothed around our ankles. I was so in love with both of them. I remember saying to my mother, "I didn't know it could be so easy to be this happy." And she'd say, "Hearing you say that just makes my day." And I could imagine how she'd be smiling as she scrubbed energetically away at her kitchen with a dishcloth and a bottle of spray and wipe. Because all Mum ever wanted was for me to be happy. I always thought she was just weirdly selfless until I started taking care of Jack. And that's when I began to get an inkling of how your child's moods dictate yours, and how maybe that becomes a habit. I do remember that once she said, "Do you think Patrick is as happy as you?" And I said that of course he was just as happy as me. There was a pause, and then she said, very carefully, tentatively, "It's been less than a year since he lost his wife. He still must be grieving, Saskia. It takes such a long time. Just maybe keep that in mind." She was qualified to talk on the subject because my dad died when I was a toddler. I don't remember a thing about him. I certainly do not have any repressed feelings of abandonment by my daddy. I know my father was the love of my mother's life, according to her, and I know she said she missed him every day. But that doesn't mean Patrick was the same. For one thing, Mum didn't meet anyone else who could have made her happy. Patrick met me. I made him happy. I know I made him happy. I'm not stupid. I didn't imagine it. Of course I knew a part of him was still grieving for Colleen. I was deeply respectful of Colleen's wishes about Jack's upbringing. She had written down a list of instructions. Her writing was shaky because she must have been quite ill by then. Her spelling wasn't the best. It was uncharitable of me to notice that, I know, but there you have it. I've never held out myself to be a particularly nice person. Colleen believed in vitamins, so I gave Jack his vitamin tablets every day. Colleen believed that singlets somehow protected children from all evil, so I put singlets on him even when I knew he was probably going to be too hot. I'm sure Colleen didn't mean for the poor child to wear a singlet on warm days, but Patrick took everything on that list, literally. And Patrick was happy with me. He said he was happy. He said, "You saved my life." He said, "I'm keeping you forever." He said, "I would have been lost without you." Today, I lay on the beach and dreamed of Colleen. In my dream, I was screaming at her, "There is no need for an apostrophe and the word vitamins!" So, that's a pretty embarrassing, nerdy dream, screaming at a dead person about her grammar. Somebody said, "Big night?" And I opened my eyes, and there was a man standing on the sand staring down at me. I was looking straight into the sun, so I couldn't see much of him, except that he was wearing a knee-length wetsuit and carrying a boogie board under one arm, and had woolly hair that seemed too young for him. I sat up and looked down at my red dress. I guess I did look like someone who had passed out after a big party, except I'm too old for that kind of behavior. I said, "Sort of." Then he didn't seem to know what else to say.
He smiled and put his fingers to his forehead in a sort of salute and kept walking down to the water. I sat on the beach and watched him on his boogie board. He wasn't very good at it. He kept trying to paddle for waves and then missing them, but each time he finally managed to catch one, he got such a funny, excited look on his face, his woolly hair lying flat against his forehead. This afternoon I went into one of those surf shops, and I don't know what came over me, but I somehow walked out carrying a wetsuit and a boogie board. I guess I'm going to have to learn how to ride it now, or surf it, or whatever the right terminology is. I'm quite chuffed about it. Ellen woke on Monday morning feeling drained and wrung out, and was horrified when she opened her appointment book to find her day filled with back-to-back appointments without even 5 minutes for a lunch break. She could vaguely remember thinking blithely to herself, "Oh, I'll manage," when she'd scheduled so many appointments. Now she thought longingly of her bed and how truly, amazingly glorious it would be to slide back under the blankets and sleep the day away. If only she felt properly, contagiously ill with actual symptoms, then she could get on the phone and cancel all her appointments. But she knew she was just worn out. There had been too much eating and drinking and nervous socializing on the weekend. Too much heightened emotion, too little sleep, and too much sex. She suspected she was coming down with a bad case of cystitis. She was also out of milk, which for a few moments as she stood at the open fridge seemed like the end of the world. She actually stamped her foot. She needed the crunch of cereal contrasting with the coolness of milk. She put stale bread in the toaster with fast, sulky movements as if the person responsible for the lack of milk was watching and feeling guilty. She went and picked up the newspaper from the front yard, where the delivery person had considerately thrown it straight in the middle of her front hedge so that she had to rustle through unpleasantly damp, dewy leaves to retrieve it. Then, to top it all off, as she was eating her toast, which tasted weirdly acidic, and reading the paper, which was full of bad news, murders, fatalities, wars and suicide bombs, the world was adrift on a sea of tears, she came upon an article under the heading, "A-List Turns Out for Society Wedding." And there was a picture of her client, Rosie. It had been about 2 months since Ellen had last seen her, and during that time she'd lost a lot of weight. All her curves were gone. Her shoulders were bony and hunched in a strapless wedding dress, and she was surrounded by 4 tall, skinny bridesmaids in floor-length gowns. So she'd gone ahead with the wedding. Her revelation under Ellen's supposedly skillful hypnosis that the reason she wasn't having any luck giving up smoking was because she didn't really like her fiancé had meant nothing at all. Either she'd decided that she didn't really feel that way, or she was marrying him anyway, maybe for the money or the prestige, or because she didn't have the courage to cancel the wedding after all the invitations had gone out to the A-list. Either way, it left Ellen feeling even more depressed. It made her feel pointless and incompetent. The phone rang and Ellen quickly answered it, hoping for a cancellation, ideally of the morning's first appointment so she could go back to bed. "Good morning," she said briskly. "This is Ellen." "Doesn't sound like you're having a very good morning at all." It was Harriet, her ex-boyfriend's younger sister. They had stayed friends after Ellen and John broke up. Harriet was a tiny, brittle, bossy woman, and very occasionally her somewhat malicious conversation was exactly what Ellen felt like, in the same way that she sometimes found herself oddly craving the bitter taste of black licorice. But right now, the sound of Harriet's slightly nasal voice shredded Ellen's nerves like a cheese grater. She took a deep, bracing breath as though she was about to run up a steep hill and said, "How are you, Harriet?"
"Fine, fine. Just thought I'd call for a chat. It's been months."
Only Harriet would think that 7:30 on a Monday morning was a good time for a chat.
"Yes, yes, too long," said Ellen and let her eyes briefly close. She felt an absurd desire to scream.
Whenever she spoke to Harriet, John suddenly jumped to the front of her consciousness. She could hear his voice and the similar speech patterns of Harriet's voice. She could see his heavy-lidded half-smile, half-sneer. Harriet reminded her that John still existed. She preferred to be bright and bubbly and moving full steam ahead with her life when she talked to Harriet, so that the appropriate messages would get back to John. She knew that Harriet would make sure she mentioned every conversation to John. That's what she did. collected information and then shared it around. Little pellets of power. Ideally, Ellen should mention Patrick right now. Have you heard? Ellen has a new boyfriend. But she didn't have the energy to give him the enthusiasm he deserved. How's John? She said instead. Let's bring him out on center stage instead of letting him lurk about in the corners of this conversation. Funny you should mention him. You're not going to believe this, but my eternal bachelor of a brother is getting married. We're all in a state of shock. Can you believe it? No, said Ellen. She cleared her throat. Goodness. She had lived with John for 4 years, and the word marriage had never been mentioned. It had been her understanding that he didn't believe in the institution, and it never seemed to occur to him to ask how Ellen felt about it. In fact, he just didn't believe in marriage to her. Her feelings were quite badly hurt. She actually felt them break like a row of fragile porcelain cups that had exploded all at once. There were shards of pain flooding her body, tiny ones prickling her sinuses, a huge sharp one lodged in her chest. Oh, for heaven's sake, you don't care. You're in love with another man. You're properly in love for the first time. You don't care. You don't care. You don't care. Except she did. He's only known this girl for a few months, continued Harriet. She's a dental hygienist. A few months. After just a few months. Maybe John was properly in love for the first time. And it was fine that Ellen had never properly loved John, as she now realized, but it was not fine that John had never properly loved her. Why? Because she was the nice one. Anyway, we're sure it won't last, said Harriet. Her voice faltered a little as if she was pulling back now that the damage was done. Had she deliberately called first thing on a Monday, when any normal person's defenses are down, to pass on this information just to hurt her? She must have known it wasn't going to be welcome news, and yet Ellen knew that Harriet was genuinely fond of her. Oh, well, I hope for their sake that it does. Ellen was impressed with the cool, detached tone of her voice. Listen, Harriet, can I call you back another time? I'm having one of those mornings. I'm out of milk, and I woke up in such a bad mood. Touch of PMT, said Harriet. She'd always been one of those women far too happy to talk about her menstrual cycle. Just got out of the wrong side of the bed, said Ellen. She put down the phone and cried. Harsh, jagged, angry sobs. It was ridiculous. It was way out of proportion. This is your ego, she said out loud. Her voice sounded loud, childish, and broken in the kitchen. This is just your ego. She could think of nothing worse than to be married to John. She did not miss him. It had taken a long time for her to reinstall her personality after he'd systematically taken it apart, making her doubt her every thought. He was a selfish, pompous, egocentric, nasty man. She did not want to be married to him. But she did not want him to marry someone else. She did not want him, but she wanted him to want her. It was stupid and immature, and yet there it was. She couldn't seem to wrestle control of her feelings. She cried and cried. It was an orgy of outlandish sobbing and wailing. She wanted to pick up the phone and call him. She wanted to scream, "What was wrong with me?" She wanted to see this girl. She wanted to watch them together. She wanted to listen in on their conversations. Oh, Saskia. I understand. I know. I get it. Finally, after much heaving of the shoulders, loud snotty sniffs, and sudden fresh flurries of tears, it was over, and she felt remarkably cleansed, exhausted, shaky and pale, but fine, like she just vomited up the last of a rancid meal. Good Lord, how peculiar. Maybe Harriet was right, and she really did have PMT, although her hormones were normally well-behaved and didn't cause such dramatic waves of feeling. She picked up her diary to check when her period was due. She flicked back and forth through the pages, slowly at first, and then faster and faster. It wasn't possible, was it? Finally, she put the diary back down and stared out the window of the kitchen at the sea. I'm going to stop. I'm over it. I'm done.
Ironically, those were the actual thoughts going through my head when I went for my appointment at the hypnotist today. She didn't look that great when she opened the door to me. Her skin looked blotchy, and her hair seemed sort of lank, and there was a greasy food mark on her top. I felt quite cheered by the sight of her. And then, before we had our session, when she asked if I needed to use her bathroom, as she always did, I said yes, because I actually really did. Out of habit, I automatically opened the mirrored cabinet above her sink. I wasn't really that interested. I knew exactly what I'd see. The supermarket brand moisturizer, the contact lens solution, the deodorant and razors, the handful of lipsticks and the little bottles of essential oils. I nearly missed it. I was about to close the cupboard door when something different caught my eye. A long, flat, rectangular box. I picked it up without much interest, and then I felt something snag in my chest, like a sharp hook dragging and tearing at my heart. It was a pregnancy test. I recognized it because I'd used this same brand myself, many times. The box was open. I opened it and pulled out two long white plastic sticks. She'd already done both tests, wanting to double-check the result. The little window on both tests showed the same symbol. The symbol I had longed for but never, ever seen. The hypnotist is pregnant. Chapter 9. You shall see nothing, hear nothing, think of nothing but Svengali, Svengali, Svengali. Svengali's instruction to Trilby O'Farrell in the classic novel Trilby by Georges du Maurier. She kept forgetting for minutes at a time, and then remembering. It was only 7 hours since she'd done the test. After putting down her diary and staring out the window for at least 10 minutes, she had suddenly gone into a frenzy, as if someone else had taken over her body. She'd thrown on dirty clothes, driven into the village and double-parked in front of the local chemist, which was only just opening. The chatty grey-haired lady who normally sold Ellen hay fever medication had kept her face politely uninterested when Ellen asked her for a pregnancy test, and double-sealed the top of the white paper bag while talking about the funny weather for this time of the year. Her first appointment of the day had knocked on the door while Ellen was sitting on the edge of her grandmother's bathtub, holding both undeniably positive pregnancy tests in her limp hand. The morning passed in a blur. She had no idea whether her work had been abysmal or brilliant. She had chatted and listened and induced trances and written out receipts while an amazed voice in the back of her head chanted over and over, "I'm pregnant. I'm pregnant. I'm actually pregnant." It was much too soon, only 3 months. Their relationship was far too new for the words, "I'm pregnant." It felt tasteless and tacky, like something that happened to a teenage couple on a soapy. Also, it was too medical. "My period is late as a result of your sperm accidentally colliding with my egg through something faulty or slippery or otherwise relating to our condom usage, and I did a test that confirmed the level of pregnancy hormones in my urine, and there you have it." Putting that aside, did Patrick even want another child? At all? Ever? She thought he did, but now that she considered it, she saw that her beliefs were based on flimsy evidence, such as the fact that he adored his son, and she'd once seen him smile tenderly at a stranger's baby, and his mother wanted him to have more children, and he seemed very fond of his mother. Also, he was a lovely man, and lovely men should automatically want more babies, because it was a biological imperative that they pass on the loveliness gene. In fact, it was quite possible he'd smiled at that stranger's baby because he was thinking, "Thank God that's all behind me." She felt a cold chill at the thought. It was ridiculous. She knew so much about him. He was frightened of spiders. He couldn't see the point of cucumber. He'd once punched a boy called Bruno. But she didn't know this one essential point. And let's assume he did want another child. What would they actually, literally, do? Would they move in together? Into her house or his? Get married? She didn't want to live in his house. The bath was too shallow and the kitchen too small, and the color of the living room carpet was bad for her soul. She loved her grandparents' house and working in this room and falling asleep to the sound of the sea.
But maybe it would be disruptive to Jack to move him out of his home. And what about Jack? Was he ready to have a little brother or sister? A little brother or sister. That gave her another fresh start. The baby was either a boy or a girl. That was already decided. Oh my goodness, she was having a baby. She suddenly felt weak with a strange feeling that she thought might be equal parts hysterical terror and blinding joy. A baby. Ellen, could we get started? It was her 2 o'clock. Louisa. She had just returned from using Ellen's bathroom and was looking at her with a faintly angry expression on her attractive, sculpted face. Ellen had always sensed an undercurrent of barely controlled fury in Louisa. She was a relatively new patient, a daughter of a friend of Julia's mother. She was seeing Ellen for unexplained infertility, and she had made it quite clear that although she didn't actually believe in this sort of mind control stuff, she had got to a point where she was willing to try anything. She said she was also seeing an acupuncturist, a herbalist, and a dietitian. Imagine if Louisa knew that Ellen had accidentally, clumsily, foolishly, inconveniently become pregnant. The world was an extremely unfair place. I was in my late 30s when I met Patrick, so I knew if I was ever going to have a baby, he was my only chance. It wasn't like I had to beg him or anything. He said yes straight away. He even seemed excited by the idea. He kept talking about how he didn't want Jack to be an only child. But then, as the months went by without anything happening, he seemed to lose interest. He didn't want to talk about it, and he refused to see any doctors. He didn't even want to try on the right days. He said, "I don't want to hear that you're ovulating," as if ovulating was something disgusting. In all honesty, he was a bit of a bastard about it. I forgave him. I understood that it was different for men. They don't have the biological drive. He said, "Saskia, my love, if it's not meant to be, it's not meant to be." Which was true. We had Jack. Except that it wasn't true. He had Jack. I didn't have Jack at all, and I wasn't his love. Turned out that it was meant to be. He was meant to have another baby. Just not with me. "Sorry, what did you say? You're inviting me to a Tupperware party?" Ellen was on the phone to Danny, the young hypnotherapist she'd been mentoring over the past year. "Ha! Yeah, right," shouted Danny. He appeared to be calling from a nightclub. He reminded Ellen of Patrick's younger brother, Simon. That generation seemed to have a different dialect or accent or something. They all sounded ever so slightly American, and there was an amused casualness about the way they saw the world, as if nothing was beyond them. Maybe it was technology. It put power in their fingertips. Or was that the way Ellen had sounded when she was 24 too? No, she'd never been casual about anything. "Let me just go outside for a moment," said Danny. "I'm pregnant, Danny. Pregnant. That means I'm having a baby. And I've only been dating the guy for 3 months. What would you do if your girlfriend told you she was pregnant after only 3 months? Okay, is that better?" The background noise had vanished. "No, what I'm saying is, you know how you've got Tupperware parties, right? So I was just standing at the bar and listening to these two women, middle-aged, mothers, I guess, and they were talking about how much weight they needed to lose, and their personal trainers, and how long you need to run on the treadmill to work off a roast potato, and you could tell they were, like, passionate about this shit." "I'm having trouble following," said Ellen. "Hypno parties! I'm gonna run weight loss hypno parties. So all these women can get together and I can give them a group hypnosis session for weight loss. I'd use Flynn's rapid induction techniques you were telling me about. He wouldn't mind, would he? These chicks would be in the perfect receptive state anyway. Then a standard script with a few positive affirmations, maybe an aversion suggestion for every time they look at a roast potato or open the fridge. But they've got to cook dinner for their kids, I guess. Anyway, I can work out all the details. What do you think?" "I'm not exactly," began Ellen. "It's perfect. How much do you think I could get away with charging?" "Well, I don't know," said Ellen. "I always prefer to individually tailor treatment to the money they spend on these personal trainers. I could get them better results." "Maybe you could." All the women would fall in love with him. He'd been the only male in the introduction to hypnotherapy course Ellen had taught. and he was attractive and charismatic, but in an understated way that made you think you were the only one to have noticed.
When he was doing Ellen's course, he always took a seat at the far right of the room, and Ellen had noticed the way all the other students unconsciously leaned toward him, like flowers bent by a breeze. She could hear a girl's voice in the background now calling out,
"Danny, I've been looking everywhere for you."
"I bet you have," thought Ellen. When Danny looked at you, he held eye contact. It was a gift. Not many men could do that without appearing psychotic.
"So anyway, I've got to go. The idea just hit me and I wanted to see what you thought. I'll call you, okay? How are you anyway, Ellen? Sorry, I never even asked."
He didn't sound perfunctory. He sounded like he genuinely cared. Maybe he did. Or maybe he was the ultimate salesman. "I'm fine, Danny. You go." It was later that night, and Ellen was slouched on the couch watching Beauty and the Geek and using her fingers to eat a plate of roast potatoes, which was all she felt like for dinner. It wasn't like it was the first time in her life she'd ever experienced a strong desire for a particular type of food, but now that she was pregnant, she felt entitled to label it a craving. Perhaps the baby needed potato. Or perhaps it was just that Danny had mentioned roast potatoes and her subconscious had obediently responded to the suggestion. She allowed these thoughts and words to cross her mind. "Now that I'm pregnant, the baby, craving," and felt as though she was doing something slightly illegal. She couldn't just waltz into that whole complicated world of motherhood without some sort of official entry pass, could she? What was the entry pass? A marriage license? It seemed crazy that, as of yesterday, the thought of having children was still something far in her future. And then today, after one trip to the chemist, she was craving roast potatoes and thinking about the baby. Next, she'd be having pickles and ice cream for dessert. The carbohydrates and the bad television were putting her into a sort of half-comatose state. Her head felt stuffed full of cotton wool. Baby brain. "Enough, Ellen." The phone rang and she put her plate to the side and heaved herself off the couch with a grunt. Now she was even walking like a pregnant woman, with one hand supporting the small of her back. She made herself stand upright. She really was the most suggestible person in the world. It was her godmother, Melanie. That was good. Mel didn't really like talking on the phone and was always in a hurry to finish up the conversation. She would be quick, and Ellen could get back to the enjoyably stupid beauties and the endearingly geeky geeks.
"I just wanted you to know how much I liked Patrick," said Mel. "I really, really liked him. And such an improvement on that John. Such a self-satisfied prick. I hope you don't mind me saying that."
"The self-satisfied prick has just asked someone to marry him," said Ellen.
"Oh, that poor girl," said Mel with genuine feeling. "What a lucky escape for you."
And just like that, John was safely locked away in the filing cabinet at the back of her memory where he belonged. Ellen felt a surge of gratitude and affection for both her godmothers. Pip had also called earlier today and left a long, rambling, giggly message on Ellen's voicemail all about soulmates and wedding bells, and was she too old to be a bridesmaid? Of course, Ellen's own mother hadn't called yet.
"Your mother liked him too," said Mel.
"Did she say that?" said Ellen.
"Well, no," admitted Mel, "but I could tell. Speaking of your mother, did she seem herself to you on Friday night?"
"I think so." Ellen dragged her mind with difficulty to her mother's behavior on Friday night. Hadn't Anne been her normal self? Ellen had been so focused on Patrick and herself, she hadn't really spent much time observing her.
"Why?"
"Oh, nothing really. She's just a bit, secretive lately. Like there's something she's not telling us."
"Look, I'm currently dealing with a very big secret myself. I don't have time for my mother to have secrets too. I'm meant to be the young, interesting one."
Why couldn't her mother be dull and staid, with the major upheavals of her life safely behind her, like Patrick's mother? These were the childish thoughts that crossed Ellen's mind as she looked longingly at her roast potatoes and the flickering television set.
"You don't think she's sick or something?"
she said in a sudden panic that she was about to be punished for her selfishness.
"No, no," said Mel. "How stupid of me to worry you. She's in perfect health. She flogged me at tennis just the other week. I'm probably imagining the whole thing, or I'm just desperate for gossip. Ignore me. The whole point of this phone call was to tell you that I really liked Patrick. Now, I must let you go. Talk to you soon.
She was gone. Nobody ever finished phone calls more abruptly than Melanie, unlike Philippa, who spent at least 20 minutes wrapping up each conversation. If it had been Pip saying she'd noticed something strange about her mother, Ellen would have put it straight out of her mind, but Mel wasn't the type to imagine things. Her mother must be hiding something. Of course, that wasn't necessarily a bad thing. People were allowed to have secrets.
I myself have a secret, said Ellen out loud. It was an unusual feeling. She couldn't remember the last time, if ever, she'd had a secret of this magnitude, one that would give people a little shock.
Just you and me, kid. We're the only ones who know about this. She would keep it that way for a while longer.
She was halfway through another roast potato when the phone rang again. This time it was Julia.
I can't believe you set me up with a guy who comes up to my armpits, she shrieked.
Sorry, said Ellen with her mouth full. I didn't know. It was so tempting to make Julia shriek even louder with two little words. I'm pregnant.
And he looked like he stepped straight off the set of Farmer Wants a Wife.
I thought he was sort of sexy, actually, said Ellen.
Of course she must resist telling her about the pregnancy. Patrick had to be told first.
I didn't say he wasn't sexy, said Julia.
Ellen's eyebrows popped.
I see.
After you and Patrick left, he walked me to the car and asked me out for a drink.
What did you say?
I said yes, just as friends, obviously.
Obviously.
It warmed her heart to hear the change in Julia's voice. The brittleness was gone. She hadn't sounded like this in years.
And I found out his real name. It's Sam. I knew it wasn't Bruce.
Oh, hey, I forgot to say that I loved Patrick. He's gorgeous. Don't mess this one up.
Thanks for the vote of confidence.
I'm serious, Ellen. He's a keeper.
Okay.
Well, that's handy, seeing as I'm having his baby.
I mean, John was so pleased with himself, mused Julia.
Why does the truth always come out later? Everyone behaved as if they adored John when I was with him, said Ellen.
You all used to fall about laughing at his jokes.
Yeah, he was sort of witty, said Julia distractedly.
Are you watching Beauty and the Geek? See the blonde girl with the bulgy eyes? Don't you think she looks sort of homicidal? Speaking of homicidal, you didn't tell me that Patrick's stalker breaks into his house.
I didn't know. Ellen watched the bulgy-eyed girl on the television screen. She'd quite forgotten about that new revelation regarding Saskia. What would she think if she knew Ellen was pregnant? Would that be enough to cure her, or would it tip her over the edge into insanity? Had she ever wanted to have a baby with Patrick?
Anyway, I've got to go. My mobile's ringing. Might be Sam. I'll talk to you later.
She hung up. As soon as Ellen sat down on the couch with her roast potatoes, the phone rang again.
Hello, darling. It was Patrick. For some reason, it had become one of their rituals that he always put on a deep American cowboy voice whenever he said hello.
What are you doing?
Watching television and eating potatoes.
Ellen felt guilty, as if every second she didn't tell him about the pregnancy was a betrayal. But it would be wrong to tell him over the phone, wouldn't it? And frankly, she didn't want to hear what Patrick thought about it just yet. It was already confusing enough working out how she felt about it. His feelings would add a whole new layer of complexity to the situation. If he was thrilled by the news, she would back off. It was too soon. It was all wrong. The sensible thing would be not to let this pregnancy continue. If he was horrified, if he suggested a termination, she would be devastated. She wanted this baby. If he said, I'll stand by you, whatever you decide, she would be annoyed. It was their problem, not just his. Basically, she couldn't think of any way the poor man could react that would please her. How was your day? She said, trying to keep her voice natural.
It was fine until you-know-who showed up at the office.
You-know-who? Said Ellen.
Oh, of course, I do know who. Poor Saskia, he always refused to use her name.
She was even crazier than usual, crying, talking about babies.
Babies, said Ellen. Her blood ran cold. Did Patrick already know? Was this some creepy way of letting her know that he knew?
What did she say about babies? She asked.
She laced her fingers through the curly cord of her grandmother's phone. The phone was green, over 30 years old, with the old round rotary dial face that you slowly turned with one fingertip.
Oh, I don't know. Seriously, I don't listen. I told her she needed psychiatric help. She handed me yet another letter and begged me to read it.
Did you?
Of course not. I stopped reading them years ago. It's always the same old crap.
Anyway, look, do you want to get out of Sydney for a long weekend? I just had this sudden desire to get on a plane and escape this cold weather. And then I got an email about cheap flights to Noosa.